This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. After the killing of Michael Brown last summer, protests drew national attention to law enforcement's increasing use of military equipment. Cameras were trained on police in Ferguson, Missouri, as they brought out mine-resistant vehicles, combat-style assault rifles, and gas masks, gear more often associated with conflict in the Middle East than the Midwest. Those images sparked debate over a federal program offering $5.6 billion worth of military equipment straight from the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan to U.S. municipalities under the auspices of fighting terror. And these things aren't just happening in Middle America. You may recall the local fight over Keene, New Hampshire's request for a Bearcat to repel terrorist activity at its annual Pumpkin Fest. Molly Redden is a reporter in the Mother Jones Washington Bureau. She reviewed hundreds of local law enforcement requests for armored vehicles and other military equipment to find out why they wanted it. Here she is speaking with Virginia Prescott.
So first, a little more on this federal program 1033 offering armored tactical vehicles to local police. Now, what's the stated goal of the program?
So the program was started, it was smaller back then, back in the 90s, to provide local law enforcement agencies with means to fight the war on drugs and fight crime in their neighborhoods. But the program didn't really balloon and become the massive source of funding that it is today until after the attacks of 9/11. And after that, the funding for this program really expanded under, as you said, the auspices of fighting terrorism. And alongside that, several other federal funding streams expanded to, you know, do the same thing, to arm police forces in ways that somewhat resemble military units in the name of fighting terrorism. So, you know, this 1033 program, they directly provide equipment that's coming off of those battlefields. These other programs that are sort of imitators and are even larger than the 1033 program now, they provide money.
You looked at how many applications for this kind of equipment?
More than 450, somewhere around 463, 465.
Now, were there more applications made after Ferguson?
So we wish we knew. I filed my Freedom of Information Act request shortly after Ferguson in October for all the requests starting in the year 2012 through October of 2014. And just in August, I received the results of that request. So I wish I could tell you what happened in the year after Ferguson, but I might have to wait another 8 months to get that answer, just because these requests do take a long time.
Well, what were you after in filing that FOIA request and looking over these applications?
So I wanted to see what law enforcement agencies said about their need for this equipment behind closed doors. In the aftermath of these protests, when all eyes were on police advocates to explain themselves, you know, why there was this combat-style equipment in police armories all over the country, they spoke a lot about the need to have that equipment in a worst-case scenario, in a scenario that they have to plan for but they hope never occurs. So school shootings, terrorist attacks, active shooters, hostage situations, natural disasters where roads are impassable. You know, that's what they talked about publicly. And of course, they do that because that's really understandable. You want to protect citizens. You want police in shootouts to be safe. Those are sympathetic reasons. But behind closed doors, when they're sort of speaking in the privacy of these forms, these applications to the Defense Department, their reasons are really different. And what their reasons resemble is, you know, a lot of what civil rights activists have seen in how police now deploy SWAT teams. They say their SWAT teams are for those worst-case scenarios, but really they're to serve arrest warrants. They're to serve search warrants. They're for drug interdiction. And those are the patterns that we saw in these requests. Now, there are some goofy requests, too, like the Pumpkin Festival one. We saw some on that order. But, you know, really, it's just an astonishing look at how police imagine themselves outsourcing routine policing activities, drug policing, serving search warrants where the person who's the subject of the warrant hasn't even been found guilty of a crime, how they're outsourcing those to these sort of paramilitary teams.
Well, here are some of the goofier requests. An armored personnel carrier with blast-resistant floors to guard a 200-acre beach town in Delaware. In Chesterfield County, South Carolina, and there's 46,000 people live there, sheriff requested a vehicle that could withstand both roadside bombs and a type of machine gun round that could shatter concrete. Another one, the Ohio State University Police Department requesting an armored vehicle for football missions. Now, what does that mean?
I have no idea. I have no idea what a football mission is. However, we do know that they got their mine-resistant vehicle, and it started showing up on game day at their football stadium. And the department told a student newspaper on the campus that they wanted to have a quote-unquote presence at the games.
Law enforcement in hundreds of American towns have filled out applications to request MARPs, or mine-resistant vehicles, and other military surplus equipment from the federal government in order to help them do their job. Well, Molly Redden is with us. She's a reporter for Mother Jones. She reviewed hundreds of those applications to see what exactly they were asking for. Well, it certainly sounds pretty over the top in many cases. But what do we know? I mean, does bringing out the big guns actually escalate conflicts? Do we have any kind of data on how the equipment changes or alters police response?
Different civil liberties groups have looked at this question. The ACLU did a pretty great report on how SWAT teams were being used. In America, they looked at about 800 SWAT incidents, and they found that, you know, most of them involved the sort of paramilitary gear. There wasn't necessarily good enough data in all of the SWAT reports to indicate whether or not these vehicles showed up. But, you know, all of this stuff that we're talking about is usually used through SWAT teams and to outfit SWAT teams. That's why we sort of talk about these in concert with one another. So what they found is when you have these paramilitary policing units, what you end up using them for is more and more routine activities. So they found that these units would show up, you know, to serve search warrants. And in a lot of the cases, the object of the search warrant, drugs, you know, they weren't found at the scene. Sometimes they would deploy them with the explanation that it was known that the subject of the search or arrest warrant had a gun. Well, you know, 50% of American households, somewhere around there, there's a legal gun owner in the house. It's permissible for that person to have a gun. And they found that, yes, having this equipment in your arsenal pushes you to use it that way, to sort of use it more routinely. And part of the reason is that the 1033 program, they have a use it or lose it policy. You have to demonstrate that you've used it a year after you received it. And so that causes police to not hang on to the stuff until there's a worst case scenario. If they want to keep it, they have to use it in more regular situations.
Well, I want to return to that pumpkin festival for a moment because I think it ties in with this. Now, here in Keene, New Hampshire, there was a fight over the Bearcat, and John Oliver on This Week Tonight, you know, he famously had a laugh at the town for requesting a Bearcat to maintain security at its annual pumpkin festival. Now, there was a riot at last year's Keene Pumpkin Festival. Lots of property damage, you know, cars turned over. Protesters were chanting, "Bring out the Bearcat." It never apparently left its secret spot in a garage. So it's like even the awareness of military equipment raises the stakes. What do you think is going on there?
I'm sure some law enforcement advocates have said or will say, look, we did need this piece of equipment. There is that potential for this attraction in our town to cause this unrest. And, you know, I think that's a sympathetic argument. And what civil liberties advocates say in response is that we have to look at the patterns of policing, the patterns of what people use this for. Yes, there are these odd scenarios, and it's totally understandable that every town would want to be prepared for them. That, you know, everybody imagines what if the worst were to happen, or maybe in the case of the 2014 Keene Pumpkin Festival, what if the weirdest were to happen? I think what people should be encouraged to think about is how unlikely is that? And also, okay, if that were to happen, what would you use an armored vehicle for? Armored vehicles can't really be used to corral people. I mean, basically, the physical function they serve is to protect officers or to protect the people inside, usually soldiers, from heavy gunfire. And so in that situation, what would you use it for?
Well, it's pretty clear that you regard these documents as evidence of fear-mongering and being pretty much over the top. But do some local police departments actually have a need for this sort of equipment?
You know, I think what some people are trying to get folks to do is to think through, okay, this looks big, this looks protective. And, you know, a lot of officers say, we use these for door pulls. We can go right up to the side of a building, you know, open the door, blast the door off. We can get our people really close to the scene of heavy gunfire without our people being in harm's way. And that's true. That is a legitimate use for it. But that's not what we're broadly seeing police use it for. And also, the situations are incredibly rare. And, you know, I've also spoken to police who say, look, half the time that we use this stuff, we plan out everything in advance. So it's not like every town in America has to have one. You can have one an hour away, 2 hours away, and you can know that you're going to be conducting a truly dangerous raid, a raid for which you have good intelligence, not just that person has a gun permit, that you should be protected during a SWAT raid. And, you know, you can call up your local agency and they can send you one in 6 hours, and that works for you. And that's what some police have advocated for. You know, I closed my piece with an interview with the Chesterfield County Sheriff in South Carolina, and he says, look, if we need something like that, we'll just call the state. And so I think that's sort of the balance people have to think about. I don't think there's a right answer because, sure, something bad can happen in any town. And so I think what every town has to ask itself is, how do we want to prepare for that? Do we want some of these strategic locations for all officers to have access to? Or do we want one of these in every town in America? Are we that afraid? I think that's the question at the heart of this.
Molly, thanks for all your work, and thanks for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with Molly Redden. She recently reviewed hundreds of local law enforcement applications for the use of military equipment. The results of her investigation are at Mother Jones, and you can find a link to read them at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about the increasing militarization of local law enforcement agencies all across the country. Well, if you think an armored vehicle stands out in a peaceful suburb like Keene, New Hampshire, imagine a federal prison built at the center of a major city. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible has this story.
Chicago is next.
If you want to stand out as a skyscraper in Chicago, you've got your work cut out for you.
I've stood at this corner a zillion billion times and never looked up at this building.
There's the Hancock Building, there's the Sears Tower.
Yeah, you're supposed to call it the Willis Tower now.
Yeah, I'm not going to call it that. And then there's my friend Dan Weissman's new favorite building in the South Loop.
A couple days ago, I was at the Cultural Center, and there's like a map of Chicago architectural landmarks. I mean, it's got zillions of buildings on it, houses, everything, and this building's not on it.
Even if a building is designed by a prominent architect.
It's by this guy, Harry Weese, who made the DC Metro. He's a big deal.
And even if that building has only three sides, it's like a triangle from above.
Like a grilled cheese sandwich, cut in half, diagonally.
And has these irregularly placed long vertical window slits.
Just like a punch card or a Scantron card.
It's still hard to stand out as a skyscraper in Chicago.
99%. 100% invisible.
I remember the first time I noticed it, I was like, what is that building? And someone there was like, oh, it's a jail.
My name is Jack Hartray. I was the project manager on the Campbell Correctional Center,
which most people know as the Metropolitan Correctional Center, or MCC.
It's a federal detention facility. It's where you stay when you're waiting to go up on trial in the federal courthouse, which is like two blocks away.
When it was built, nobody much liked the idea of a federal jail downtown.
The mayor didn't want this building built in the loop.
It's right across the street from a club called the Union League Club, which is one of the kind of fancy elite clubs in the city. And people were like, we don't want prisoners, you know, mooning us from the windows of the jail. And this doesn't seem like it's going to be really good for property values.
So there was a lawsuit, actually.
But to their legal misfortune, they had to bring the suit in federal court. So the only people who were going to hear the suit were also the only people in town who wanted the thing built. They were federal judges.
And I think it took them about 12 minutes to get the thing kicked out of the court. It was impossible to get a judge that wasn't in favor of building the building.
The architects in Harry Weiss's group were tickled by the prospect as well.
Jack Hartray, who worked on the building, said,
I think everybody in the office figured that you had a certain number of unindicted criminals in the city, and then you had some that had gotten caught.
And the MCC was just for the people who happened to have gotten caught.
And because the architects took it seriously that the inmates were innocent until proven guilty, they thought,
let's make this as nice as we can. You know, somebody already looked at this problem. How do you make a really small space cozy?
Harry sort of viewed this from the standpoint of the accommodations on sailboats. The furniture was all built in, so you could really do pretty nice furniture.
Built-in hardwood furniture. It has these really clean lines. The bed, there's a desk. I've seen this picture. It's really, you know, it's nice.
We built rooms to scale in our office. And my children used to come down and take naps. And they loved the interior space. It was, you know, kind of intimate and pleasant.
It was cozy.
Yeah.
And those narrow slit windows I mentioned earlier, those are floor-to-ceiling windows to let in as much light as possible, but they're also built just narrow enough at 5 inches so that they were within the federal guidelines of the time to not need bars.
Sounds really nice.
Oh, it is nice. Yeah, no, it is. It's not a bad place to stay.
I saw an interview with Harry Weiss where he said that what he had in mind was like a hotel.
Well, we were doing a hotel at the same time, and this was better than the hotel, you know, as far as the built-in furniture and all of that.
Show me the hotel.
Dan has a reporter's tenacity like you wouldn't believe, but he just couldn't get the warden to let him in to the MCC to see if all these beautiful Harry Weiss interiors and designs were still intact.
So I called around thinking, like, well, who gets inside these places? And I ended up talking to a guy named Phil Kerrigan.
If you went into the facility and talked to a random bunch of detainees, they would be aghast at that description, or would maybe want to go over and clutch a throat. That is not the case.
Phil Kerrigan has been going to the MCC for over 10 years.
He is kind of the designated volunteer for the MCC, and he goes and visits guys who don't have anybody else to visit them.
MCC is not a star. It's very drab, gunmetal gray. You know, the physical facility is nothing to show off.
The cells, the architect described them as being really nice, with all this kind of hardwood built-in furniture, for instance.
They're gone. The bunks are steel two-tier structures, no wood.
And do you have sunlight coming in?
No. The windows are generally frosted. Doesn't allow for sunlight to come in. You know, and the place is old. It's definitely undergone some changes, and none of them have been for beautification.
By the time Dan talked with Robert Brugman, who wrote a book about Harry Weiss, he was pretty bummed out.
There's something about this that seems kind of sad to me. You know, Harry Weiss is a brilliant architect, and this seems like it's one of his signature projects. His conception is not what exists today.
True, but you know, there are Harry Weiss buildings going down all over the country, and that's true of almost all architects of that period. So this is a minor matter that the inside of a place that was never meant to be public has been changed. you know, it is, after all, not a hotel.
Even if the warden had let Dan into the MCC, it wasn't the MCC that he wanted to see. For that matter, it wasn't the MCC that Harry Weiss wanted either.
That was Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible. I'd like
to buy word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. In 1971, Coca-Cola launched their now famous I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing campaign. It was an effort to tie their brand to peace, goodwill, and consistency at a time when American consumers were inundated with daily images from Vietnam and news of civil discontent from around the country. The real Coke is still the best-selling soft drink in the world, and people still ask for it by name. But nowadays, people also call it by another, Mexican Coke. Once a rarity on supermarket shelves, Mexican Coke is now showing up all across America, from hipster bars and bodegas in Los Angeles to New England Costco shelves. But is the beverage, made with cane sugar and sold in the classic contoured glass bottle, really more authentic than the American brew, made with high fructose corn syrup encased in plastic? Journalist Ann Glusker wrote about the complicated past of Mexican Coke for Smithsonian.com. Here she is, speaking with Virginia Prescott.
Is it just the sweetener and the bottle that distinguishes the American and Mexican Coke?
Exactly. It's just a question of what the sweetener is. And a lot of what my piece was about for Smithsonian was about that there's this sort of false idea, I think, out there in some parts of the food world that high fructose corn syrup is evil and sugar is better because it's quote unquote natural.
That's not true?
No, it's actually not. It's a myth. Jane Brody in the New York Times has written a lot about this. I myself, when I'm shopping for my kid, I steer well clear of anything with high fructose corn syrup in it. So I don't want to pretend that I'm a fan of high fructose corn syrup, but it's just there's this myth that sugar is better for you. It's really just any sweetener, you know, that's bad for you. There's a guy named Robert Lustig out at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, who's sort of the country's leading expert on childhood obesity. And he calls high fructose corn syrup the most demonized additive known to man. I would rather have something with sugar than a chemical, but it's not that sugar is so fantastic.
Well, so do all those who are attracted to Mexican Coke. Who is drinking Mexican Coke?
Well, I think it's a combination. I first became aware of it personally when I was living in downtown New York, and, you know, it was sort of a hipster drink. You know, you go into places and there'd maybe be hand-squeezed pineapple raspberry juice and nothing chemically, and then there'd be Mexican Coke. This fairly well-known sort of pan-Asian chef named David Chang, who runs the Momofuku Noodle Bar, which mm-hmm. is sort of a cool fusion-y place in downtown New York. He started serving Mexican Coke and caused this big explosion in the Twitter sphere because he was charging $5 a bottle or a serving or whatever it was. And so people thought that was a lot of money, but it was not widely available here when he started serving it. And so it was expensive. Now you can actually get Mexican Coke at Costco. So I think hipsters are part of who drinks Mexican Coke, but then I, you know, have a neighbor who loves it and swears by it and swears that she can taste the difference. Consumer Reports did a really interesting thing where they sort of tried to do blind taste tests and lots of people couldn't really tell. But my neighbor, after I published that piece, went on Facebook to tell me that Mexican Coke has a decidedly different mouthfeel. Mouthfeel being the sort of technical foodie word for, you know, when you taste chocolates, you know, you always talk about the mouthfeel. I'm a food person, so I sort of am familiar with that word. But when she used it, I just laughed to myself.
Well, okay, maybe the mouthfeel is different, but is American Coke with this much maligned high fructose corn syrup better or worse ethically than Mexican Coke?
Right. This article came about in relation to a Smithsonian exhibition called American Enterprise. And the curator of that exhibition, he's the one who really has some interesting thoughts on the difference in how these two substances are produced. So his point is not that it's the high fructose corn syrup that's bad ethically, but it's the sugar, interestingly, because he's saying high fructose corn syrup is produced in American factories that are worked by unionized workers who make it a living wage and, you know, are subject to all the United States OSHA, you know, the health regulations, et cetera. And that in Mexico, the sugar and agricultural industries are still pretty 19th century. It's what he calls a debt peonage system, you know, what we might have had in the US after the Civil War, sharecroppers, where you're in theory free and working on your own, right? But you're always trying to pay off the rent on your little bit of land. So Peter Liebold, this curator at the Smithsonian, makes the point that it's not just a question of what you're putting in your mouth, you know, if you prefer quote unquote natural sugar to high fructose corn syrup, but that ethically, in terms of the workers who are growing it or producing it, depending on whether you're talking about the natural thing or the chemical, that, you know, they're just subject to very different kinds of working conditions, which I thought was fascinating. And honestly, I hadn't thought about until he made that point.
Right. In addition to labor, Mexican Coke is now mired in a complicated international trade situation. Now, what is going on?
Well, this is over now, but it's been going on for about the last 10 years. It seems what happened is that Mexico, like many sugar producing countries, is trying to protect its sugar industry. I mean, this, of course, goes on with many industries, right? But so they were trying to protect their sugar industry, and they wanted candy makers, sweet makers, soda bottlers, not just Coke, to use sugar. That would be a way of protecting and bolstering their industry. But Coke bottlers and all these other sweets manufacturers, right, were starting to use high fructose corn syrup, less expensive, et cetera. So what Mexico wanted to do was place a tariff on the importation of high fructose corn syrup so that, you know, to discourage manufacturers from using it. The U.S. and Mexico then went before the World Trade Organization, the WTO, which is an international body, and they ruled actually that Mexico couldn't do that. So this has been going on, my guess is it'll bubble up again. This is probably just a continuing war. Because I'm a food person, I'm much more interested in the taste. You know, whenever I see that Hecho en Mexico, you know, sign on the thing, which means made in Mexico, you know, my little ears perk up. And I think many food people's ears perk up too, because they think, oh, you know, it's more authentic. It's more real. The real thing is more real when it's made in Mexico.
Well, the real thing, Coke and other sweet soft drinks, have been blamed, or at least in part, for the obesity epidemic in the United States. And the New York Times Well blog recently wrote about Coca-Cola funding research that concluded that it is exercise, not diet, that's a key factor in obesity. Should we take Coke's word on nutrition?
No, we definitely should not. This organization, this new supposedly health organization called the Global Energy Balance Network, turns out to be funded by Coke, as the New York Times has revealed. And what they say is that exercise is the key to sort of a healthy weight level, not calories, not what you eat, which is just patently ridiculous. And that just clears the way for guilt-free eating of sugary foods and drinking of sugary drinks. So, of course, that's to Coke's benefit. And that's just not, that's the science doesn't bear that out. I mean, of course, many of us who are aware of health and nutrition and exercise know that, you know, we should do both.
How about you? Have you tried Mexican Coke?
Oh, yeah, I had Mexican Coke long ago when I was living in downtown New York, and it was sort of starting to appear, you know, these sort of hipster cafe menus. And although I'm not a soda drinker, I grew up in a household with, you know, no soda, all that. My mother was very healthy. She had many other faults, but she was very healthy. And I'd see them in these sort of, you know, hip downtown New York restaurants, and I finally thought, I'll try it. And I do agree with my neighbor. I think that you could taste the difference, the mouthfeel. Although, if you did a scientific double-blind test and asked me to differentiate between, you know, Diet Coke, Zero Coke, Mexican Coke, I'm not sure I could do it.
If not just the taste, you propose that Mexican Coke's appeal might be more ideological. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, not so much ideological, but I think there's a feeling sort of in some parts of the food world and some parts of the population in general, some younger people, a feeling that, you know, people want authenticity, whatever, and I'm saying authenticity in quotes, right? People want what's real. not just because Coke calls itself the real thing, but in general, you know, that we want to move back to the land, or we want to try to go off the grid, or we want to raise our own chickens. I think there are people who just feel something that is, you know, hecho en Mexico is going to be better, realer, more authentic than something made in a factory somewhere in the United States.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with journalist Ann Glusker, who wrote about Mexican Coke for Smithsonian.com. You'll find a link to her article and more on the American Enterprise exhibition at the Smithsonian, which features Mexican Coke. All that at wordofmouthradio.org. You'll see them on Instagram, blogs, and on YouTube. Farmers market selfies, guides to organic produce, clever hacks for cooking ambitious recipes in tiny kitchenettes. It seems like young people love to photograph what they had for dinner and fixate over food culture. But why are millennials, some of them anyway, so obsessed with food? 4 years ago, Eve Turow set out to answer that question and recently released a book about her findings. Word of Mouth producer Molly Donahue spoke to her and brings us this story.
One of the big questions I had when I jumped into this project was, are we as narcissistic as everyone says we are?
That was Eve Turow. And yes, she's a millennial.
You know, if you Google millennials, it's one of the first things that pops up is people calling us like lazy narcissists.
And sure, maybe that explains the rise of the selfie or time spent on social media, documenting what they're doing, who they're with. But look at any popular Instagram account and you'll see the real obsession is with food. Eve explains that the reason doesn't really have to do anything with food per se. It has to do with what food isn't.
Really, the basis of it is food is the anti-technology.
Hold on, hold on. I know you're thinking that millennials love technology, and they do. But
the connecting line between everyone I was talking to is that people were finding a connection with food as a respite from their time in front of a computer or on their iPhone.
According to Eve, all that time spent in front of a screen has left a lot of millennials pining for something tangible. And just because you grow up with a computer doesn't make you an engineer. Millennials may be glued to smartphones, but crack open that case, and most of them are just as lost as any baby boomer ever was.
I don't really understand how my iPhone works. I don't understand how the internet works. I don't understand whether I've been hacked or not. there's a whole other land of uncertainties that we're raised with. And millennials are finding comfort in understanding what they're eating, who it's being sourced from. And that can be the case whether you're breaking down a recipe or you leave your job to become a butcher and break down a cow.
It's something we all know. Tech is complicated. But food is simple. And it's not just about personal satisfaction. There's also a deeply social aspect to why millennials love their food.
You know, we grew up in this world where we've had to manage multiple avatars of ourselves online. So you need to be someone else on LinkedIn, then on OkCupid, then on Facebook, then on Twitter. And the upkeep of that, which is required, right? It's required to get a job. It's required to get a date. The upkeep of that requires that we are constantly thinking about self-branding.
Eve says that foodie culture offers four things that millennials crave. Sensory input, social currency, community, and a form of control. It also allows them to make sure that everyone knows they're having a good time and eating good food. And if parents are any indication, it's a message that's rubbing off.
And now my parents are familiar with, like, harissa.
That's hot chili pepper paste.
And that's because of me. That's because of they ask what I made for dinner last night and I tell them and explain it to them. And now when we go out to eat, they're picking out things that they probably wouldn't have picked out before. You know, my dad wants to eat off the offal menu.
And that's organ meat.
Not really sure he would have done that before.
But not all millennials are a part of foodie culture. Eve remembers the other half of the millennial generation as well, those who are not going out to brunch with Silicon Valley coworkers.
It is a privilege to be a part of foodie culture. So I could have written an entirely different book that would be about millennials who can't afford a nice meal or don't know where the next meal is coming from, because that's a massive subset of this generation.
Beyond personal branding, and in spite of their me generation reputation, the millennial obsession with food will have some social effects that go beyond positive to positively necessary.
Millennials are 1/4 of the U.S. population. And the way that we buy food, the way that we purchase overall, is going to affect the U.S. economy. It is going to affect U.S. trends, and we're seeing that reflected. Agriculture and the environment is probably going to be one of the key issues that millennials face in our adulthood. And so it's fabulous that we have a growing population of people who are more and more aware of this. On the flip side, there is something that's kind of superficial about the way that we're interacting with food. Specifically, I talked about this with Michael Pollan and with Anthony Bourdain. You know, both of them really came back to me and said, you know, there really isn't a better thing than for people to be interested in food. And if people are learning about chefs and learning about recipes, even if it is on this superficial self-branding level, they are more likely to think about what they're going to feed their kids, whether that's going to be organics or fair trade food. But the real question is, how do you bring more and more of those people into the fold to think a little bit deeper?
For this whole generation, and the next one too, "you are what you eat" takes on a new meaning. And don't be afraid to jump on the bandwagon. This trend is probably going to last much longer than your new iPhone. For Word of Mouth, this is Molly Donahue.
People try to put us to down.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Eve Turow is the author of the new book, A Taste of Generation Yum: How the Millennial Generation's Love for Organic Fare, Celebrity Chefs, and Microbrews Will Make or Break the Future of Food. What do you think? Are you a 20-something foodie? What's the attraction for you? Or if you're the parent of a millennial, do you think they have a different relationship with food than you do? Or do you think millennials eat the same meals? The only difference is that they post them on Instagram. Join the conversation taking place on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. When we come back, more on the foodie revolution, the growth of amateur butchery classes, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Since supermarkets started offering prepackaged cuts of meat, local butchers have been on the decline. But with the rise of foodie culture and a renewed interest in where food is coming from, a new type of class is being offered for so-called conscious carnivores. And Guy Hand brings us the story.
There was a time when the word butcher didn't dredge up thoughts of slasher movie mayhem.
I bought a meat shop just the other day.
The neighborhood butcher was as revered as the baker and the candlestick maker. But in the 60s, as industrial meat packers began delivering pre-cut chops to supermarkets, America's butchers started closing shop.
I guess I'll have to sell it because I'm giving too much away.
Today, though, a revival has begun. As small-scale producers of quality meats and poultry proliferate, so too has an interest in artisanal meat cutting. And that brings me to Haley, Idaho, in a classroom strewn with lamb carcasses.
Excuse me. I'd like to welcome everyone to our first ever butchery class. And I'm already telling you.
That's Cheryl Bennett of Lava Lake Lamb, a small-scale producer of organic lamb based in the Wood River Valley. Lava Lake Lamb is sponsoring this one-day class for more than a dozen people.
This kind of came about for several reasons. We've been seeing some articles and seeing some web stuff about butchery classes, and it's kind of the vogue thing right now, actually, which is fairly interesting.
Butchery classes are becoming surprisingly popular in cities like New York, San Francisco, and Portland, Oregon. There are so few old-fashioned butchers left in America, they've attracted a kind of rock star following of knife-wielding groupies, some willing to pay thousands of dollars to learn this arcane art. Many plan to open their own boutique shops, but people at this class are here for more personal reasons.
I'm just really interested in good food and knowing where it comes from, so I'm excited to start from the beginning here.
Shot my first deer this year and had somebody else butcher it, and I want to get one step closer to the ground, shall we say.
We're fascinated and interested in providing local, good, organic food for ourselves and our 2.5-year-old daughter.
I like to cook, and I thought it'd be fun to learn more about cuts of meat.
I've got an anniversary coming up, and I think this would be a really good idea for a gift for my wife.
Okay, so you'll just kind of gather around the table.
Longtime Rigby butcher Brent Jones is teaching the class. He stands knife in hand over a pink, skinless lamb carcass, its legs stretched out as if to leap away.
A lamb is broken down into four major primal cuts. A primal cut is anything that is in a solid piece before it goes into a portion steak.
Jones grabs a hoofless leg and pulls it toward him.
We have a leg. On that leg is a shank, and that's considered one piece.
No one seems the least bit squeamish. There's no blood, no guts. The carcass is clean and smells fresh, if slightly metallic in that raw meat way. When Jones plunges his knife into the animal, people lean forward.
Right here is where your tri-tip comes from. And on this
Brent
lamb,
Jones thinks this growing nationwide interest in butchery is born in part from fear, a fear that our modern food system isn't safe.
Everybody's concerned about where their food's coming from. And that's all started since, in my opinion, 9/11. You know, everybody's worried about terrorists, they're worried about contamination, they're worried about recalls on all these meats. People want to know where they can get product from birth to plate. And what I mean by that is where the animal was born at and how it has been handled before they put it on their plate to eat it.
The recent recall of yet more E. coli tainted beef and the revelation that some producers sterilize their meat products with ammonia, well, that leaves a bad taste in many consumers' mouths. Some become vegetarians, but others have decided to take personal control over the meat they eat. Still, Jane Timberlake looks a little perplexed as she cuts into her lamb carcass.
I'm just trying to get through some of the bigger cuts and then remember what some of the smaller pieces are, waiting for them to pop out at me.
And have you done this sort of thing before?
Closest I've come was Thanksgiving, just deboning a turkey breast. So this is a little bit bigger.
Scott Mason, a local restaurateur, thinks learning the art of butchery will make participants more sophisticated cooks and consumers.
For a lot of people, I think food had become something that they bought prepackaged and they didn't understand even what they were eating. And so I think most of the people here, if you said, this is a top sirloin cut, they'd say, oh, a top sirloin cut. They know exactly where that comes from.
Mason thinks a butchery class can also make the abstract real, reminding us how meat gets to our plates.
You know, if you can't understand where it comes from and what it actually is that you're eating, you shouldn't be eating it. And so I think it's really important to know that these are whole animals. They were alive once. We killed them so that we could eat them.
That's, of course, why most of us pass the butchery off to others. Facing the facts of meat means facing life and death. Still, by distancing ourselves from our food, a growing number of eaters believe we've lost control of what we eat. A butchery class is one way this knife-wielding gang of students hopes to retake that control.
I've got the butcher blues and I just have to close my door.
In Haley, Idaho, I'm Guy Hand.
I've got the butcher blues and I just have to close my door. Christmas is getting
Thanks for listening today. There's lots more from the program at wordofmouthradio.org, including more on the connection between millennials and food culture, and a quiz to see if you can tell the difference between weird vintage recipes and meals cooked up by food-obsessed millennials. And don't forget, if you love the show but 2 p.m. is a tough time for you, you can listen anytime, all the time, by subscribing to our podcast. There's a link to subscribe on the website, or you can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you're into it, tell a friend, because the best way to share what you love is word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby. Join us again tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.